Mackenzie,
Lamar.
we are covering Ready or Not, a terrible concept, if we're being honest. It is, if you watch the trailer for this, you were like, what the fuck? But revolves heavily around games or board games. So just wondering, do you have a favorite board game? I'll let you choose. When you were a kid, did you have a favorite game? And then as an adult, are you if you're still playing games, which some of us are, no judgment here, do you have a favorite now?
Don't even get me started on like the board game adult community. It is wild. I have friends in it. You are more into it than I am, but I have
Yep,
some
I'm
friends
one
who
of
are
those
like
friends, yeah.
developing games. Like, if you
Okay.
want a new game, let me know. I got a homie. But we had very limited board games actually when I was a kid, which I think was interesting. I didn't realize how many games there were until I got quite a bit older. I definitely thought there were these like core four or five games, including, Monopoly, Sorry. What is the clicker one that I'm blanking out on right now, where you like in the middle?
That's Sorry, isn't it? Where you click the button
No,
and it
where there's
rolls the
like a thing
dice?
you click in the middle that like rolls the dice.
Yeah,
It's
that's
like a little,
Sorry.
no, Sorry doesn't do that. Sorry
Yes, it
doesn't do that.
does. Sorry does
No.
that. Or trouble.
No.
Now I feel like an idiot. It's Pop-O-Matic
Yeah,
trouble.
you were
It's
adamant and you were
literally in the name.
wrong. That one.
I
Okay,
just lost
cool.
all my board game cred.
All your board game cred, and we're not editing it out. Okay, it's there. Anyway,
Fair.
so some of those were like core that I thought that that was like all that there were. And then I slowly learned that this other one that I thought was also like a core board game is in fact not, but I loved and still love to the degree that I bought a recent version of it for my nephews and niece, which is Labyrinth. You ever heard of Labyrinth?
I've heard of the movie. I've not heard of the game.
The game, it's so great. It's so nerdy. And so, it is like the Minotaur in the labyrinth, and you're trying to escape the Minotaur, but there's these core pieces on the board that, like, so it's a maze, and you're supposed to try and get through the maze. But the whole shtick is that you can move certain pieces, but not others for pathways. So, like, think about a
Okay.
maze that changes and moves, but the Minotaur is still like at a certain spot, and then you move around and try to escape it and whatever. Anyways, it's equal parts nerdy and difficult. And I don't know. I really loved it. And apparently, nobody fucking played this
I
game.
was gonna say,
Nobody
so
knew what I
this
was
has been
talking about.
around since you were a kid? Like, this has
Since
been.
before I was a
Okay.
kid, like my mom said, it was like she played, and maybe not when she was a kid, but she played it when she was much younger. They still make it because I bought a Harry Potter version for my nephew and niece for their sorting ceremony, because of course I did.
What
So yeah,
houses
they
did they
still
get
make it.
sorted into?
I have a Gryffindor, a Hufflepuff, and a Ravenclaw
Okay.
in the fair. They just run
Okay.
the gamut. Yeah.
Why no Slytherins? They're Slytherin's the best, objectively.
Okay, so you're a Slytherin, is what you're telling me.
Yes.
Really ambitious. Okay, good to know. We got to talk about that later. Yeah. So, anyways, that was one that I really like. That's the nostalgia
Well,
plus,
now
like,
I
I think
want
it's
to play it.
nerdy and weird and it's fun. Yeah. What about you?
Okay. As a kid, I think I liked the concept of Mousetrap more than I liked playing the game of Mousetrap. But setting up the trap and making it do all the things looked cool, but I didn't like actually playing the game where you had to walk around the thing. I would just set it up and do the trap.
Can you tell
But
by my face that I have no idea what you're talking about?
you've never played Mousetrap? It was like the
I
first
don't know what you
experience I
mean.
had with how do you pronounce it? Rube Goldberg devices, where each thing triggers another thing. Like that's
Yeah.
Mousetrap is, but you set this whole thing up at
But
the
it's a board
start.
game.
Yeah, you set this whole crazy contraption at the start that at the very end has a trap that falls on like this one space. And you're supposed to play the game where people move around and then eventually you set off the trap like one time and it captures people. That's not fucking fun. Like, I don't want to do all this work just to see the trap go once. So we would just set it up and keep running the trap over and over again.
Wow, I have no frame of reference for this. I have nothing. I'm like, I don't know. I mean, I agree with your assessment based on the limited information that I have,
It blows my
but
mind you played Labyrinth, but you never played fucking Mousetrap. So we're gonna go to Goodwill this weekend and find a Mousetrap game with
I was
three
gonna say, do you
missing.
have Mousetrap now?
No,
Like, do
no.
you? Okay. Yeah, I was gonna say my adult game is maybe like Cards Against Humanity is easily my like favorite adult game, which I don't it's think a fun that, I don't party know if that counts game. As a I've, board game though. I don't think that counts as a board
it's
game.
It's a good social game. It's a good thing to bust out at parties. I'm fine with it. It's not my favorite of those, but I feel like there's a game
but you're going to. You have the expansion packs? Cause
I've played so many of them, dude. It's just, yeah. I feel like there's a game that it's similar to your Labyrinth because a lot of people haven't played this because I helped kickstart this game over 15 years ago at this point.
He's like, I single-handedly made this game happen.
Pretty much. I'm giving him a plug now. So I'm still obviously an investor in the product.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
This game, I don't even know that they ended up selling in stores, honestly. I think you might have to go to their website, but it's called Camp Grizzly. And you will understand why I love this so much because it's essentially a Friday the 13th summer camp slasher board game where you pick
a stereotypical
character from those types of movies. So you can be the jock or you can be the cheerleader.
When was this Kickstarted? Right after Cabin in the Woods? What is it?
It actually probably was pretty close, honestly. It might have been a couple years before. But it's basically cooperative, so you're all playing against the psycho killer, and he is just controlled by the dice, basically, and trying to kill you guys. But that's probably my favorite to bust out. Like, my friends seem to enjoy that one. As far as, like, a more well-known one, Secret Hitler, which I know that's offensive to some folks. You can call it Secret Dictator if you want, but that's like a bluffing game where some of you are good guys and some of you are bad guys.
Oh, is that the one we played at Armadillo?
Yes, that sounds about right. So for those of you that don't know from Austin, Armadillo Den is a bar.
I had never played it, but when I like met up with y'all there, we played something that I feel like sounded similar.
Yeah, it's kind of like you're flying under you're playing good people against bad. For the record, it's called Secret Hitler. Yes, that's kind of offensive, but the fascists are the bad guys, so they are the villains in the game.
We don't have to apologize to fucking Hitler. Like this podcast is not a Nazi apologist podcast. We are anti-Nazis and dictators and fascists.
I had a friend who, when I said, "Oh, do you guys want to play Secret Hitler?" was offended. He was like, "Why would they name him a board game after that guy?" Blah blah blah. Like, he was Jewish. I get it. So I'm not gonna say that it's okay for that, but I want to make
part
it clear.
Again, like,
the game is to kill Hitler.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I was gonna say, like, maybe naming it something else. I hear you, but yeah, the goal is to kill Hitler. Fuck that guy. Yeah.
I think they did. I think they released the game in Germany, and there it was just called Secret Dictator. They changed the name, you know, obviously for those reasons. So, but I enjoy that one because I like lying to my friends and you know, pretending to be a good guy when I'm really a bad guy. So,
Are you good at poker? That's my next question.
I'm pretty damn good at poker.
We should have a poker night. I was going to say, we should have a poker night. I'm weirdly good at poker. For my not having, like, right. Like, for my not having a poker face in, like, my day-to-day life, I'm pretty good at poker, actually. So, all right. Well,
we've talked so many games, and now we have, we got us.
Now we have so many options. Mm-hmm. We have a list of movies we have to cover. We have a game list we have to cover. We've accomplished a lot in this particular recording session. So
we'll do we'll get some people together for a poker game next Friday, and then we'll play Mousetrap right after.
You're going to teach me how to play Mousetrap is what that will be about. 100%. Okay, let's roll. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I'm Lamar.
And we are continuing with our Love Stinks Month because stupid love. And we're coming in with a fun one, Ready or Not, which is like a horror flick.
I want to pat us on the back, you specifically, for the variety that we've put into this
month. I think we've did a good job, yeah.
I feel like it would have been very easy to just pick whatever the opposite of a rom-com is, like a drama that has like a sad couple involved. Mm-hmm. And instead, we've got sort of a horror comedy. We went deep with The Eternal Sunshine and the super artsy-fartsy movies. We got Gone Girl, which I don't even know what you...
Thriller, blockbuster vibe,
And then we got, I have never seen Blue Valentine, so next week will be interesting.
Deep in the feels is what you will be. In the feels. Deep in the heaviness.
Sad. Yeah.
Plan to be sad. Plan to be have some heaviness. Don't plan to do anything that same day. You know what I mean? Like, yikes. Yeah. But yeah, this is a very different vibe, very fun. So yes, a lot of variety this month. What are we drinking to get us through this one?
Well, we are drinking 2 ounces of gin, 0.75 ounces of lemon juice, 0.75 ounces of strawberry puree. You're going to shake that up, pour it into a glass with a little bit of room because you're going to top it off with bubbles. So I used Prosecco. Did you use Prosecco?
I did.
We're calling this LaBelle's Toast. So if you've never seen this movie, fucking hit pause and go watch it.
But it'll make no sense to you. Yeah.
So toast to LaBelle.
Cheers. Toast. All right. So we are talking Ready or Not, like we said. 2004? I feel like it's 2004.
No, this was after 2004. No. That was Eternal Sunshine. That's right.
I was going to say, let's mark this. I was like, why do I have
it. So guys, as you can see, I have the glasses on, which means we're in the back half of a doubleheader. I'm pretending that it's a different week, but nope, that's just the magic of cinema, baby.
That's your Clark Kent Superman costume change. Like, you're like, they won't know at all.
They'll never know this is the same. Yeah. I could have a newspaper behind me with the date on it, and I would still put on these fucking glasses for episode 2.
I mean, it works. It's a different look. I should do that for myself. I have glasses. We could have coordinated.
Or just wear like a cowboy hat or something a little different.
I have a lot of accoutrement in this room. I have a sorting hat. Should I bust out the sorting hat? Yes. Right here, ready to
Anytime we do a double feature, you should do that. So all that to say, guys, there's going to be some mistakes.
Gonna be a lot of things. We're gonna just leave it uncut for y'all, and you get to experience us at the back of a doubleheader, like you said. But this is a 2019 film, is what I have.
You were
since
close.
I was super close. I was reading it. I was reading it and going, "This is incorrect, right? This year is wrong. That's wildly off." Anyways, it is incorrect. However, my ratings are not so. 6.8 out of 10 on IMDb and an 89% from critics and 78% from audiences on Rotten Tomatoes. So like kind of a healthy 7 to 8-ish range, 7 to 8.5.
So it's where it belongs. That is exactly accurate to the rating across the board of where this film should be. Yes.
Stamp. Lamar approved. Yeah. All right. We got it. So director on this, we have Matt Bettinelli Ulpin, which is what a combo of a hyphen of a name, but he's done a few things. Scream 6. He did the Scream reboot in 2022. He did Abigail. So we are seeing a trend here, obviously, right? He co-directs this with Tyler Gillett, who has done also Abigail, also the Scream reboot, but then also another one, VHS, which I haven't seen. And I glancing at it and poking through it made me very curious. Mostly because I actually grew up with VHSs and I was like, I have questions. So yeah, have you seen that?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's Tyler Gillette or Gillette. There's no E at the end. Ooh, so the razor blade brand might disagree, but these two guys are half of a, I don't know what you would call them, like a movie making team called Radio Silence. And this group has been around since the mid 2010s. And I think VHS was kind of their breakout, but it's essentially, I don't know what the roles are. I know these two guys tend to do the directing components. Yeah. I don't know if the other two are producers, if they are writers, but VHS, their sort of breakout was they contributed one of the 5 movies to that. So VHS, there's been 7 or 8 of them at this point, and they are horror anthologies, and they are always found footage. So think Blair Witch Project, think Cloverfield, but each of these films in the series has 4 or 5 different 15-20 minute films within it. They're hit or miss, which is kind of an anthology by definition. You know, some of them are bad, some of them are good, but theirs was very fucking good, I'll say that.
But wait, so like, okay, I don't know if I'm understanding this correctly. So the VHS that I saw in IMDb, where I'm like scrolling through and seeing his, that's one anthology or that's one iteration of this anthology?
That was the original 90-minute film VHS, but in that are 5, I think, different short films.
Got it.
Then every subsequent sequel, VHS 2, 3, 4, all through 7 or 8 at this point, has 4 or 5 different short films.
Now I'm really curious because I actually do like horror anthology stuff. Like I'm not a huge like full-blown, as we know, feature film horror film person, but I loved Scary Stories, the Guillermo del Toro series that they did. I also like that, like, as just from a book thing as well. Like, I like short horror films, and I'm like an Edgar Allan Poe fan. So I like these like short horror stories.
You ever seen Trick or Treat? That was like a mid-aughts anthology.
No, because you know why I didn't? Because that looked cheesy as fuck from
it
the
is
picture.
Cheesy, but the that's fucking half the fun.
The yeah. pumpkin and the like weird. Yeah, so no,
it's definitely seen it. Cheesy. But I think the good thing about an anthology is, oh, you're not having a good time? Just wait 10 minutes. And
just
it's
wait
10 minutes.
Change. Yeah, I think that's why I love that. I will yep. say. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's the fun part about Oscar shorts coming off of Oscar season. Of course, this is top of mind for me. If you like Oscar or if you like short films in general, that's a good way to do that as well. The animated were not my favorite this year, but they're usually also like that. You're like, I'll see one that I like in 10 minutes. I'll see another one in 10 minutes. That's good.
This is our podcast in a nutshell, though. I'm like, look at these horror anthologies. And you're like, look at these Oscar films.
Look
like
at these Oscar film, films. Yeah. Look at these deep cut Oscar films. Let me philosophize this for you in some way. Yeah, yeah. Checks out. It's the whole vibe. Okay, so the writers of this particular one are Guy Busick, Scream, and Abigail also. So it feels like he's part of that little team that's doing all those productions, like you said. And then R. Christopher Murphy, who has done a couple different things, not the same things other than this. He did Castle Rock, which I haven't seen, but I've heard good things about. He also did Minutes Past Midnight, which looked interesting, but I also haven't seen. Major cast and crew. Samara Weaving is our lead character here. She plays Grace. She is so good in this. We'll get into this. I think she's really interesting. I think she draws your gaze for a number of reasons and everything that she's in. And so it was kind of cool to see her in this format. She's done 3 Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri, which I know I've mentioned before as being a really good film that you should check out. Babylon, which I actually fucking hated. And
didn't most people hate Babylon? Wasn't that a common consensus? I didn't see it, but I heard it was bad.
I think it was, I don't know if it was like universally hated, but it definitely wasn't universally acclaimed. Okay. And there were some definitely bad reviews. Maybe it evolved to being pretty universally hated, but I wanted to love it given all the people involved and even just like the production team involved. I don't know what it was trying to be, but I feel like it also didn't know what it was trying to be, is what I would say.
It's also interesting because Margot Robbie's in Babylon, right?
Yep.
And wasn't Margot Robbie terrible. The first choice for this role? And then Samara Weaving got it because she wasn't a bit, but they get mixed up a lot. They have similar facial structure. So like, that's kind of interesting. I feel like they ended up making a movie together.
Well, and they're both Australian. Like they have similar facial features. They're Australian based. Yeah. And I feel like, Margot Robbie is, I think, maybe the traditionally beautiful version of a Samara Weaving, who is also beautiful and talented, and both of them are, but she's almost like this is not an indictment. It is an observation. I want to be super clear. I don't like to comment on people's appearances, but I think her appearance is very unique. It's like, it's almost like a character. Like she is like, think about an animated character where the eyes are really exaggerated. The lips are really exaggerated.
Like Disney look. Yeah.
She's like the Disney look in real life. She really just is. It's very interesting to look at in real life. And she's beautiful. They're both beautiful. But I think it makes her interesting in a role like this and in any role that she's in. Because again, she draws your gaze. You're like, oh, wow. That's like, she just looks different. And
yeah, Janelle knows. I won't call it a crush, but
you're in love with Margot Robbie?
Well, no, Samara Weaving. Okay. Like okay. She was in The Babysitter. Which yep. underrated. I mean, if you want a horror comedy, again, it is not a 10. It's probably like a 7 or an 8. It's in that mid range, but it's a fucking fun movie. The Babysitter's really good, and she is the lead in that.
The Babysitter? When did that come out?
I want to say it was 20. It was right before COVID, so probably 2018. It was around the same time as this, so maybe a year before this. It might have been 2018.
I haven't even heard of it. Like, didn't know it existed. That's interesting.
So I'll give you a minor spoiler for it. So if you care about The Babysitter on Netflix, and you don't want spoilers for it, in this, spoilers for this movie, she is sort of being hunted in. Yeah. Because of a cult or as a sacrifice.
A situation has arisen.
It flip-flops in The Babysitter. So in The Babysitter, she is the one who is part of the cult hunting someone else. But she's in that. She was in Scream 6, which we talked about the writer and the directors both being all being tied to the Scream series. So Samara is in that. And at least 2 other cast members in this went on to be in Scream movies.
Yeah. She was also in Guns Akimbo.
I liked Guns Akimbo. It was, again, not great, but
I haven't seen it in a long time. And I remember thinking it was like fun, but I didn't.
Daniel Radcliffe, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Dumb action movie, but fun.
But I like, again, and I think that was part of it too for me, is like, I love when a Daniel Radcliffe like goes and does a thing that's different or weird. And I actually really, I mean, not to sidebar too hard, I think he's done a great job of that in his film selection. He has a really wide range in an effort to not be a Frodo or Harry Potter or whatever, like we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, we talked about that last episode of Elijah Wood doing that same exact thing of, I'm going to take some risks and play things that are so fucking far from Lord of the Rings that I can never be typecast again. And I think Daniel Radcliffe followed suit.
I think Daniel Radcliffe follows suit, but I think he does it better. I think he does it really well and does it better than Elijah Wood. I think Elijah Wood makes some interesting choices. I think consistently Daniel Radcliffe's, if you go watch his stuff that is like, you wouldn't think to watch some indie flicks, some small, you know, projects, they're all really well done.
Slightly different between, even though the two of them look very similar and I feel like people mix them up all the time, it's a little different in their career trajectories because Daniel Radcliffe, that was like one of his first film roles, was playing Harry Potter. He just got thrust into it. Whereas Elijah Wood had been around for a decade plus before he did Lord of the Rings. Like we talked about how he did The Faculty, he did The Ice Storm. He was in a fantastic movie with Macaulay Culkin called The Good Son. It's not that good, but it was okay. So, a little different.
Good-ish.
So the okay son.
The okay son. Yeah. No, I agree. And like, because Daniel Radcliffe has been a child actor before, he'd been like one other thing. It wasn't anything big. So I agree.
And then last thing, just to bring this whole thing full fucking circle back to Frodo in Lord of the Rings, is that Samara Weaving is Hugo Weaving's niece. Yes.
Jinx.
Double jinx.
We did it. We did it. Yes. And I love that because they end up working together on a project later, but they haven't done a lot of work together and they sort of independently kind of came into their own, which I think is cool. It's not like so much, and I'm sure he had connections. Don't get me wrong. I just mean, it wasn't like the same level of nepotism as you sometimes see. And she started in Australia and actually he did too. His backstory is fascinating. If you ever want a deep dive on Hugo Weaving, he's a really interesting guy. He's been all over the place. And they do one project together that I haven't seen and I'm super curious about. Adam Brody. Okay, we've made it. We've progressed to number two. Cast member number two plays Daniel. And I hate that this is my first reference for him, but it just fucking is. He was in the OC, y'all. He was in the OC for a long fucking time. He played Seth. I think
that's probably most people's first.
He invented Chrismica. Not literally. Don't get mad at me. Christians and Jews. Nobody get mad at me. But I think that was the first time I encountered Chrismica and I thought it was great. Anyway, the OC, he's a great time on that movie. Also, he's in a recent series on Netflix called Nobody Wants This, which if you haven't seen, is also very good and actually also kind of Jewish related, interestingly. And then he was recently in American Fiction, which I realized when writing these notes, we still haven't done on the pod and need to do.
Yeah, we thought about doing it last year and I ended up seeing it afterward and really enjoyed it. I also like, he had a really smaller part in Promising Young Woman, which I liked. And he's one of the other ones that was in Scream. He was in Scream 4. So not the same one as Samara.
I forgot about that.
Yeah,
okay.
He played a cop.
Yeah.
Usually they don't last long in Scream movies. So.
Which one would they? Because, ACAP. Anyway, Mark O'Brien, Alex, he is in Arrival, which I have mentioned multiple times that I do want us to discuss at some point. It's a great film, I think. It's like, y'all, if y'all want to listen to me nerd hard and like get into the weeds on some like linguistic shit, that's going to be our Arrival episode at some point. Mark O'Brien was also in Marriage Story, which you and I talked about as a potential option for this month.
Yeah,
Love Stinks. Disclaimer, I opted out and I was like, I can talk about it, but I literally can never watch it again because it is a rough one. But it's very well done, very well performed, but it's a rough one if you go watch it. Elise Levesque. She plays Charity, and she did a lot of TV. And the only one that I even recognized name-wise, actually personally, was Orphan Black. So what else have you seen? Have you seen her?
I honestly haven't seen her in much. I liked Orphan Black. I didn't stick with it.
At some point,
there were too many plot twists. I will say the main character, the main characters are played by Tatiana Maslany. So if you've never seen it, it's basically clones of the same person. So she ends up playing six different versions of the same character, which is kind of cool. One of them has a Russian accent and one of them is artsy. They're
She's
all
schizophrenic?
Over the not schizophrenic. She's a clone. So it's this one actress getting the chance to play. It's very similar to Michael Keaton in Multiplicity, which is just as good as
Multiplicity is so fun. I love that you said that thinking I was not going to like it. I know, I saw your face. I remember, I think that's a nostalgia thing for me, but I remember Multiplicity and I remember loving it. But yeah, I like
Pizza. But she who's in like She-Hulk now, and she was just in The Monkey. She's growing now, but that was her breakout role. And she's the best part of the show. I also think, not to skip ahead for you, but Christian Brune, who plays Fitch in this, I think he's also in Orphan Black. So they both kind of came out of this universe.
Well, no, that's a good call out because I didn't even include Christian, to be honest. So next up I have, this is a fun one, Nikki Guadagni. Great question if I actually pronounce that even remotely correctly, but Aunt Helene.
Italian, yeah.
And she does, she's been in Holloway, which I haven't seen, and Lars and the Real Girl, which I've seen, but it's been a long time since I saw it.
I don't remember her in that.
Yeah, like, I remember Ryan Reynolds, obviously, but I don't remember her at all.
You just couldn't take your eyes off him the whole time. Okay.
I mean, who can? Let's be honest. Woo, yikes. All right, and then Henry Searsnyi, he was Tony, the patriarch of this family, for reference. And I can never get away from him in Mission Impossible.
The first Kittredge. One, right?
Yeah. Kittredge.
Yep.
That is, he will never not be Kittredge to me. And he also, by the way, continues to play Kittredge. So that contributes to that. He just is that person. But that is my first interaction with him. And he will never not be Kittredge to me. And he did a really good job at it. So I don't, like, no judgment.
Yeah, he was the other one that was in a Scream movie. He was in Six with Samara.
Yep.
Again, minor spoilers, they're both not in the movie for very long, but they do what they can do, you know.
Yeah, they hang out for the time that they can.
You know how Scream movies go.
I was going to say, like, is it a spoiler that everybody dies in Scream movies? Mm-hmm. Not really. Clear and Present Danger, he also did, which if you haven't ever seen, like, Clear and Present Danger is great. And then Revenge is one that I wanted to reference because it's like a recent TV series. And I actually think he does a good job in that. And he's like super evil in it, actually. Okay. Andy McDowell, bringing us home with Becky, mom, matriarch of the family. She has done a bazillion things. I'm sure most of you know her from something, but she's certainly done Groundhog Day.
She was like a 90s crush of mine. When I was too young to have crushes, I thought Andy McDowell
was
the cutest girl I'd ever seen.
Yeah. Is what you're saying?
Yeah. One of those. Yeah. Andy McDowell.
Yeah. Mine was Kevin Costner. So I'm not judging you. Groundhog Day. They would make a good couple. That's such a good call out. Sex Lies and Videotape and Hudson Hawk, which I had to reference because I think that's a good one. And it's like kind of a dark horse. Like, not enough people have seen that one. That's a fun one. Okay. Plot summary. A bride's wedding night takes a sinister turn when her eccentric new in-laws force her to take part in a terrifying game. Yeah. Yeah. Checks out.
It is a terrifying game. Hide and seek can be very traumatizing. So,
I mean, I certainly had a couple that were maybe a little rough as a child. I think we probably have all, not to this degree. This is wild, but we've all had one or two probably. Couple quick production notes before we get into spoiler zone. So this made pretty good money despite, like, to me, not having a great marketing effort. I feel like you heard about it a couple of times. I saw a couple trailers. I didn't feel like there was a huge push on this one. But it had a $6 million budget and it made almost $60 million at the box office, 57.6. So
that's a good return.
It's not a bad return, but I sort of expected more for the quality. Like, I think it's good. I think this is a very accessible horror film is what I would say. So I think that they could have done even better had there been more awareness about it, actually.
Well, like you said, it was a shitty marketing campaign because I had no desire to see this. If it were not for word of mouth, I wouldn't have bothered.
No, and because I don't think actually that the premise is actually captured in any of the trailers that I remember seeing. And I think that this premise is actually kind of interesting of like, hey, we're playing this game and it follows this, you know, romantic day. Like, I think there's a way to cut that trailer that makes it look interesting without giving a shit away. And the things that I remember seeing were just really cheesy and not that interesting.
One of the first notes that I wrote down was, a lot of times I feel like on this pod, we have covered things that are really good concepts, but they're not perfectly executed. And that's why we don't rate them as highly. This is the exact opposite, where it is a super fucking dumb concept, but it's so well executed that it pulls it up. Like, the rating goes so much higher. I don't really want to go see a movie where you say, oh, it's about this bride that has to play hide and seek, or she gets killed and the family's hunting her. That doesn't sound that interesting, but this leans into so much of the comedy and the gore, but also keeping things tense and realistic that it ends up being a really great film.
Yeah. And I remember when you texted me, so like, you had watched it and you texted me and you were like, it's silly. It's exactly what I remembered. It's a good time. And I hadn't watched it yet. And I was like, ah. And so I went and watched it. I think the next night I was like, okay, I gotta watch it. And I had the same assessment of like, this premise feels, I mean, not bad, but not like it's going to turn into a great movie. And it's still a good time. So it's a good enough time to the degree that, and has a good enough return from a production method that it apparently is in production for a sequel. And it's looking like this last year, it started like production kicked off. So we should be seeing another one, and she is, slated to return. Samara Weaving is slated to return. So I think that's interesting in that it tells us a lot about where the story's going to go. Because it's gotta be something that still involves her. And like, what does that manifest?
I assumed when I heard about it, that it would be some sort of prequel of a different iteration of this, again, not to spoil anything, but yeah, that's interesting. And I know it'll have the actress from Don't Breathe in it. So I think she's teaming up with the same directing team again to work on this. So that'll be cool.
Yeah. It makes me curious, if nothing else, for sure. So, all right, homies, it's spoiler time. Turn around. Don't drown. Let's do this. So, man, my first note out of the gate is, what an energy. What a vibe. Just opening it up. And also, like, we have this beautiful scenery. We are at 1,000 immediately. We're thrust into this environment. And I'm just waiting for the other shoe to drop, I think is what it is.
The opening is pretty intense. It throws you right into it of, okay, there is this cult thing going on. Again, something you don't necessarily want to give away in the trailer, so I get it. But people are being hunted, and I like that we get introduced to two of the main characters, technically three, but I think you're only really aware of the two right off the bat, of like the young siblings at the start who end up being sort of the two conflicted brothers throughout this. Yeah. I think that's honestly, outside of Grace's character, I think the two brothers and how they feel about this whole thing end up being the most sort of intriguing part of the film. But to your point about the set pieces and how intricate the way the sets that we're working on are, I looked this up and was like shocked to see that this was shot inside of Casa Loma, which is in Toronto, Canada, and I've been there. The reason I went there was because it's in Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which I think we referenced last fucking week and probably a dozen times
and
on this podcast.
Many other times you have referenced this.
So in Scott Pilgrim, they go to the exterior of the castle in the scene with Chris Evans, and they say, because he's a movie star, they say in it, oh, they film a lot of movies here. It's this famous castle. So it was cool to actually watch a movie.
How very meta of them.
Yeah, it's come full circle.
I love it. Well, and you're supposed to feel the richness and the wealth of it all, like right out of the gate. And you're supposed to see and feel this mansion. And this mansion is like almost a character, right? It becomes a character as we progress of, it is trying to keep her in. It is telling the story of this family. It is a tool by which they keep her here. Like, I just think it's really interesting, the environment that she's in from the get-go, like in this other context, this early person, and then kind of throughout, and how we close out our experience with this mansion. And so it's visually very interesting to continue.
It feels like a member of the family. Like, it feels like the mansion is on their side and it's got 100%. All these trapped doors. And those are real places. So for the record, I went to Toronto for a bachelor party for my friend Eddie. Shout out, Eddie. I was too cheap to pay to go inside of Casa Loma. I just walked around the outside, but apparently...
Did you give him shit, Eddie? We want to know. Tell us later.
We drink and we watch things pod at gmail.com. But they all went inside. Apparently, when you're inside, you can actually walk through some of these secret passages and things like that. And did you know...
I think that's why you go into one of these mansions.
Just to see, like, yeah, how do the rich live?
Where do I pull the book? Yeah.
If I had the money to put a fucking secret passage back there in this apartment complex, absolutely would. But did you know that there was one movie that we've covered on the pod that also was filmed? I don't know if it was interior or exterior, but parts of it were shot at Casa Loma, and it's one of your favorites.
I think so. Gosh, it's funny. As soon as you said that, I was like, I feel like I've seen something here before, and it looks very familiar in general.
Think big gothic mansion. What movie might that be that we've covered?
Big gothic mansion. That we've covered. Gosh, man, you know, we've covered a lot.
We have. It was one of the very first episodes.
Is it Crimson Peak? Really?
Was filmed at Casa Loma. I don't know if it was the interior, the exterior, or
it
both.
It has to be the exterior because the interior does not match at all. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. That checks out though. Yeah. It's gotta be the exterior because the interior was like a built set on that. And
okay. It would make sense that the exterior, because it is Canada. So if they wanted to film with actual snow and whatnot,
right.
I thought it was funny when I looked up where the exterior of this was shot. It was at a different mansion on the exterior shots, but it was the same mansion they used for Billy Madison, famous Sandler film.
Also, that super checks out as well. Cause like, again, it feels familiar for sure. Well, and I think it gives you, I mean, so I have had the benefit of working, I shouldn't say benefit-ish. I don't know. The experience of working in these kinds of places with my former client base for
Canada?
Sure in mansions, in crazy big mansions.
Yeah, that makes more sense.
Back in the day I worked for a lot of millionaires and bazillionaires, and they had crazy houses, and like this just so checks out for it's like it's almost nostalgic for me in that way of like the features of the house and the things that they choose to spend money on and the security and the dumbwaiter and the, you know, like all these things where you're like this is on brand. And what is also on brand is that the family is fundamentally fucking weird. That was the thing I encountered with. There was one out of all of my clients, there was one of them, and this is over almost a decade in this industry, there was one who was like a normal dude, like a normal couple, like family, and they were, I just mean normal in that they seemed totally wholesome with no weird quirks. Every single one of them, they weren't problematic. I don't mean that. I just mean they all had something really weird about them that they thought was totally normal. And I just remember being like, girl, please, you are so not normal. You know, you are so weird in so many ways. And that definitely comes through in this family that, and I love that that's a conversation between the two of them of like, you said your family was fucked up, but you didn't say how fucked up. Yeah. And I was like, checks out, you know? Like, of course they're this weird.
She's got a soul. She's different than the rest of us. Yeah.
The rest of us do not have a soul. And I think that that's a great theme throughout this of like who has a soul and who is struggling with their humanity, you know, who is remembering and struggling with their humanity versus who has accepted the circumstance that they find themselves in and really like let that part of themselves go. I think that's really interesting here.
Yeah. I think that ties back to what I said of the two brothers throughout this and seeing how they sort of set Alex up to be the one you think has a conscience. Even in the flashback at the very start, he gets hidden in the closet while his brother is the one that's like, protecting he's over here. Yeah. And gets this guy killed.
And he calls that out later so you don't forget, right? He tells you like, hey, I'm that brother that did this thing. Yeah.
And they do a great job throughout of like, Alex, it's not as though he is two-faced. It's not as though he's actually, it's not a Get Out situation where the family where is just he's fake part from of the, con. The start.
He's part of the con.
He is has every intention, I think, at the start of this movie of leaving the family after this ceremony, like after this honeymoon night or whatever you want to call it. They're out the door.
Yeah.
The only reason he has to change his mind is because the curse takes effect, I guess.
And he's struggling with himself throughout. And like, I can't help, like the first thing that popped in my head was like performative allyship. He feels to me as like the performative ally. But when push comes to shove, who's your actual ally? And I think it has a real impact for that reason, because again, his performance is great, right? He is telling her and telling us that he is about her, that he is only doing this for her, right? He calls it out multiple times. She wanted to get married. He tells her that. He tells other people that. He says, like, he seems perfectly content and happy to have kept their life separate from this and never have gotten married. Like, that would have been, in theory and on paper, fine for him to be with her. And she has completely valid reasons for saying, no, I would like a family. Like, I want, this is important to me that I have a family. And he, in theory, does that for her. But I think, again, the performative nature of that comes into play of, well, you knew this was a factor.
That was what Janelle and I asked was, why does this family not just swear off marriage in the typical terms? I guess you could say, well, the curse, whatever, of LaBelle forces new people to enter the family and play this game to, like, eventually
but
produce a sacrifice.
Like, isn't but that like, the loophole?
Yeah. Why wouldn't you just be like, hey, we're not going to get married. We're just going to have babies. This is coming from Lamar. I'm a bastard, legally speaking. I am a bastard. In Game of Thrones, I was born out of wedlock. So, like, I just don't get why you
you're just not you're just not whole is what you're saying. No,
but in Game of Thrones, I'd be fucking awesome. Like, I could lead the Night's Watch is what I'm
so
saying.
So you're Jon Snow is what you're saying. Are
I
you
didn't
trying
to say that?
This,
I just said it, I could lead the Night's Watch.
Is this all about you being Jon Snow? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
I could also be fucking Ramsay. So I'm not saying they're all good, but
I was gonna say, let's not apply you to Ramsay. That's true. I will attest. That does not apply. However, I agree with you. I don't understand why we would not find this loophole and leverage it.
Right.
And I think part of it is the implication is such that it, and they even say this at the beginning too, of she, oh, your mom thinks I'm a gold digger. You know, your mom thinks I just want your money. So I think part of it is people do want the benefits of truly being a whole member of this family. And in the case of Daniel's wife, she wants the benefits. She is here.
Well, there's that line at the beginning that's kind of throwaway, but it might be the funniest line of the movie when Daniel says, oh, they just want to make sure you're not a gold digging whore. Like my wife. Just calls it out. It's like, Jesus Christ, dude.
Number one, I love it. The delivery is great. It lands so well. Two, it tells you a fuck ton. And then I think later it comes back a couple of different times where like their dynamic is very, he is miserable. Daniel is miserable. And he has also reached this like place of acceptance about how miserable he is, right? He's not the favorite son. He is sort of vaguely committed to this family more so than Alex, at least again, from a performative level, he's there. He hasn't extricated himself from this family. He has
he's
a wife
alcoholic.
Who went through the process. He's an alcoholic.
That's the thing. For as much as throughout this movie, as you end up liking Daniel and sort of sympathizing with him and feeling like he's sort of the other good guy, good character in this, the first introduction we get is Grace saying, your alcoholic brother is trying to hit on me. That's the first words. I noticed that on this rewatch. The first thing we hear about Daniel is he's an alcoholic and he's flirting with the bride. So we already see him in a negative light, but eventually throughout the movie, he earns your respect back.
I also don't know if that is a casting choice that made that hard to believe, but for me...
You were like, he was on the OC. He's so sweet.
He's Seth. He's a gem. He's adorable. No, but
and now he's got a beard. I love him.
Yes. You know, I love a beard. Yeah, no, I definitely didn't. Well, I shouldn't say I didn't buy. Like, I bought the, like, tortured alcoholic in him, for sure. I don't mean that. But, and again, this is where I question, is it a casting choice or is it, you know, looking back on it in hindsight is 2020. But I feel like I never wholly bought into him as a bad guy. I don't think I ever wholly bought into him as a bad guy. And I think also how much of him flirting with and liking her is his knowledge of who his brother probably is deep down, right? What we get to come to find out about Daniel is, again, he protected his brother early on. He wants to keep him away from these things, but his mm-hmm. brother is still to a degree, of course, aware of the choices that they have to make as a family. And he chooses to he just wants to pretend like it doesn't exist. He just wants to leave and not face the music. Versus it feels like Daniel has really faced the music, but struggles with the humanity of that, the morality of that, all the things. And so how much of that is him dealing with it more than Alex ever has and really facing himself and the darkness in himself and all the things. And he probably also sees in Samara or Grace's character, the same things that we heard Alex say, who he's like, she made me feel like I could be a better person. She made me feel like I could pull myself out of this family and this dynamic and be a wholly good person, versus Daniel's wife does not. Daniel's wife knows right. exactly what's going on, and she fucking leaned in and she doesn't give a shit. And so I think that he also loves her in a different way of like, she also gives him some kind of hope and access to like the way that it should be.
I saw a theory about that. And when does LaBelle choose to make a sacrifice? You know, there's this curse and it's just, you're going to pick this yeah. random card from this box and it's going to tell you whether this person has to die or not. And apparently, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in the movie, it feels like the last time this happened that they actually had to kill someone was with Aunt Helene's
husband,
who we see at the beginning yeah. of the movie, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The theory and that
there
I
was somebody
saw,
else before that who just like didn't participate and they just all died.
They yeah. died anyway. Yes. Yeah. yeah. So the theory that I saw was that LaBelle senses that Grace is good enough to pull this family member out. She says at the beginning, I've always wanted a family. That's why I'm doing this. Like, I was an orphan and I mm-hmm. love him and I'm so happy to be a part of this. As opposed to the other folks who we clearly see coming in from the outside are money grubbing and do just want mm-hmm. their cut of the family empire. Yeah. So a theory I saw was LaBelle kind of senses this and wants to test it and is like, yeah. if true love endures and you really do love each other, then you will not let them get killed tonight. So that is yeah. why Aunt Helene, yep. Her husband and Grace are chosen as the ones that have to die. And in, you know, the first case, he gets killed. And I think that that obviously makes sense for why Helene becomes so fucking bitter and angry and resentful of this. Of, yeah, we have to kill her because we killed my guy.
And she has to reach a place of acceptance about it, right? Like, mm-hmm. if you hear her speech about it later, she talks about how she should have just accepted it in the first place. And to me, that reads very much as like a person who has been through significant trauma and has to explain to themselves that trauma, right? Yep. Like, she has leaned the fuck into this because she doesn't have a choice in order to retain her sanity, because otherwise this is fucking crazy. Like, they don't really lean in as much in this movie. And I think that's actually intentional and I think it's well done, but they don't lean in as much in this movie about why this is so fucking crazy, you know? And so she is very like, I have to convince myself that this makes sense. But to your point, I vaguely agree with that theory, having not read it, because I think the person that proves their love here, the true love story here, is Daniel. And not Alex, which is what you kind of vaguely expect. And also, of course, Grace, she proves herself to be the person that we think and see that she is from the beginning. I think she retains this innocence throughout. And I don't mean because she hasn't been through some shit and she has, you know, had a life that precedes this that is hard, but she is seeking hope. She is seeking family. She seems like she's trying to pull herself out of these former traumas and lean into the goodness, lead into the hope of her potential, her life, her whatever. And I agree with you. I think that's probably what LaBelle sees in her and is like, I wonder if you can do this, you know?
That's, and how I wonder will this play if, out? Does LaBelle make the decision when he assesses Grace's character that she's innocent in this, or does he wait until the very end when she says, I want a divorce, and she says no to Alex finally, and he's like, oh, you know what, you're cool. You go ahead.
I think she, well, if we're going along this line of thought, I think that card is played because he wants to see what happens. And if you want to take it a step further, I think he's protecting her from Alex.
Fair.
Of like, I know that when push comes to shove, Alex isn't the person that you think he is. And he's been protected and he hasn't really faced the music. And when push comes to shove and he has to pick you or he has to pick him, he's probably going to pick him. And I want you to have the opportunity to see that. And if you just marry him and the game is fucking Scrabble, then you're never going to find that out about this man, you know? And you're only going to find that out in this literal life or death situation. That's the only way for you to see immediately who Alex actually is.
That's a good call of he's sort of pressing her and making a good decision for her in some way. As fucked up as it is, it ends up being the right decision.
Yeah.
But I think to your point of he's challenging her, at the end when everyone has exploded and he
nods.
Kind of gives like a tip of the hat, kind of like, you know, you did great. Cool. Congratulations. Job, you win. But so I think that's in line with everything you're saying. But I wanted to backtrack pretty fucking far and just say, can we talk about how fucking great Samara Weaving is in this? Just she has this ability to play. I wrote down all these adjectives of she can play charming, dorky, naive, badass, like a vixen. She can alternate between, and she does all of these in this film. And I love her little like snort laugh because it shows kind of the dorkiness and how she's not as concerned about appearances as this family that she's dealing with. But just wanted to take a second to appreciate how this movie might not work if it weren't for her.
It just makes her, well, not just, it makes her very relatable. She is very relatable. And also, again, you can't ignore, and I think you choose an actress like this for a reason, right? She can be dismissed from members of the family as a gold digger. That's not outlandish. But you look at someone like her who is gorgeous, and then you're like, okay, makes sense that this person would be interested in her. Cool, makes sense. But you get to see that kind of behind the scenes thing, like you're saying, of her and her future partner, her and Alex, of her being herself around him, her being dorky and silly and sexy and fun and insecure, concerned about what this family thinks of her and how this is all going to play out and how to create connection and just wholly human.
And I also like this. Sorry to interrupt, but I like that she is a smoker. I don't know why I like that, but from the start, we're shown that this is not this put her up on a pedestal perfect human being. Not to say that smoking makes you bad, but I think in cinema, you would assume this would be this innocent person who is like lamb to the slaughter. I like that in this, she's the one smoking the cigarette in the first scene, passes to her husband. That's how we sort of end the movie. And nowadays you don't associate smoking cigarettes with being the good guy as much as you did in the 1980s, you know?
I agree and disagree with associating it with your heroine, because I think we've seen a resurgence actually in film and actually in society of this marketing scheme that still really works of smoking makes you look cool, right? And I think that is still kind of a made manifest in this for her of like, we're supposed to like her and think she's a cool girl. Like she's a real girl, right? And I think that's a little bit of that tool, both at the beginning and at the end. And also so relatable at the end of everything she's been through to be like, you know what? Fuck it. Like I'm gonna smoke something, right? Like, girl, do you. I support you. But
you don't know how her story is going to end. Is she going to go to prison for this? Do they suspect that she killed everyone and to try and get their money?
Yeah.
If she does, it's the worst crime ever committed because it seems very obvious that she's coated
in
everyone's
blood. She's covered in blood.
Like,
yeah, exactly.
The house is burning. Yeah.
It's easy to dismiss and say she can say this accident happened or she can explain this away or whatever and she'll get out of this scot-free. I think that's what actually makes the prospect of a sequel pretty interesting because you're like, hey, she maybe didn't get out of this scot-free, right? She was covered in people's blood at the time of this fire. And how will it not be read as, I murdered this entire family and I set fire to this mansion. Give me that inheritance,
please.
Right. Yeah. Give me that inheritance. I set fire to this mansion to cover my tracks. I married this man yesterday, which the impatience of that alone is wild. So, I mean, listen, you got a good lawyer. It's going to be fine. But we've established that maybe she doesn't know how to navigate certain things and do that kind of thing. So I think it's really interesting. But I think one of the things I wanted to talk about in general over the whole course of the film is, like, you set the tone from very early on. Obviously, we know from even just the trailer, like, this is going to be a horror movie, whatever. But there is a creepy factor to the whole mm-hmm. thing that is subtle but consistent. And, like, I have notes of, like, Aunt Helene, her colors that she's wearing, it's like stark. There is a stark contrast. Well,
she's
her
got
colors.
Like the white hair and
she's
the
got the white hair,
outfits.
The dark outfit and the deep purple and the mm-hmm. like intense eye makeup and the also the stoicism of her persona, like her body and her physicality.
It's very Ziggy Stardust, to be fair. So she might be going for that look. Just throwing
it
that
is,
out
but like with less color. It's like if Ziggy Stardust went bad. Yeah, totally. Like
evil Ziggy Stardust.
Evil Ziggy Stardust, exactly. And then also, like, again, Kittredge, who just plays fucking Kittredge, who has this like creepy, eerie persona about him mm-hmm. that the way he talks, his physicality, his persona, like gives this very explicit vibe. But even if you look at scenes, like this is what stood out to me was like the wedding scene. Where even if you want to remove the immediate family from that and their own weirdness and whatever, you have in theory a big audience here, their friends, family, whoever, that are at the ceremony. And even the clapping feels eerie. I have that in my notes of like the way that the whole audience, it's almost muted. It's almost muted from a sound perspective and the way that it's shot of this like slow, eerie. It does not feel joyful. It does not feel bright. It does not feel like this is your typical wedding, like from the beginning.
I feel like I'm going to have to rewatch it because I don't think I picked up on that the first time. I was surprised when you used the word creepy throughout because I actually felt I thought you were going the opposite direction. I think that the humor in this, the comedy is very perfectly balanced with what you're talking about of it. It never strays completely into being a funny movie, but it never strays completely into being a horror movie either. No. So I had in my notes all the different comedy callouts of the little pieces of the script that are fucking hilarious. We already called out a couple of them.
Which again, checks out.
I love the when he's watching the Getting to Know Your Crossbow YouTube video because he gets given mm-hmm. that as his weapon.
On the shitter, by the way. Don't forget.
I like it's a fucked up joke, but like the help getting killed throughout the film, yeah. Like all three. So, except for the butler who is earning his fucking paycheck tonight. That dude is crushing it at his
job. That is a fucking bodyguard. Like, how is he a butler? He is here. He is a straight up goon. He is a goon of this family.
And even just the throwaway lines when she, at the beginning, when Alex says, are you ready for this? Before the wedding, she's like, oh, fuck no. And we cut to the opening credit. It's, oh, this is a comedy. It's okay to laugh. It's a dark comedy, right?
But I think it's a dark comedy. That's the thing. Yeah. Like, you can totally laugh. Like, I laughed throughout and I saw all these jokes. But it's funny, again, it's funny the things that we hone in on. Like, you're honing in on the jokes and I'm honing in on the vibes. And the vibes are dark, right? The jokes are there, but the vibes are dark. And she, like, there is an eeriness to this throughout, no matter how she is the brightest thing in the room, is what I will say. In every single scene, she's the brightest thing in the room. She's got the white dress and the blonde hair and the beautiful smile and the jokes and the snark and the things that make her intriguing and engaging and all the things that make you want to talk at her, look at her, all the things. But everything else around her is not bright or joyful.
And I love how throughout the film, she goes from this. I mean, I've never wanted to wear a wedding gown before, but hers is fucking gorgeous. Like, that
it's
is a
beautiful.
Great dress. And
it's beautiful.
To
and it looks
see
comfy,
that,
actually.
Yeah, to looks, see, like, it looks comfortable, but also
it,
gorgeous.
It looks like if I sliced it the way she does, I could get some shit done. Yes.
Well, but so, like, as the movie progresses, it's getting more tattered and torn mm-hmm. and stained, and her face and her hair is getting matted. I love that progression. I mean, it's kind of a fucked up thing to say. I think it's like any horror movie where you see the characters changing over the course of the film and yep. becoming more animalistic and impacted. But I think there was a stat that I read of something like they made 17 or no more than that. Let me 17. Wait, give me one.
I think it was a crazy number of her dresses.
It was 17. They made it was 17 versions dresses. Of her fucking dress. And when you watch the movie, I think with that in mind, you can pick a few of them out of like, oh, this one has sleeves, this one doesn't, this one's ripped, like you said, this one right. is stained. But it just, I like that progression of her going through war, basically, to survive yeah. this film.
And I think they even said in that analysis of the costume designer is like, this was supposed to reflect her mental state at different times. And it is deteriorating throughout. Yeah. But what I think is interesting is she doesn't ever totally change, right? She's in a fucking mansion with a lot of stuff, right? Could she find a pair of pants and a t-shirt to wear at some point in the multiple like gaps that she had between conflicts to get more comfortable or able to face this threat? Maybe, totally. But some she doesn't. Lemons. Some Lululemon, some athleisure, yeah. perhaps, you know, some yeah. some sneakers, right?
Under Armour.
Yeah, like a Hoka sneaker. Like, you're gonna, you need some orthotic Crocs. Shoes at this point. Yes, absolutely. She has options. They're in a mansion. Let's be honest. Like, we've got options here, you know?
There's a room full of Crocs somewhere in this fucking mansion. Right, we don't talk about that room.
With all the pins, too. Like the little Croc pins. She could personalize. She could personalize in this moment. 100%. But she doesn't. She doesn't. Because I think we're supposed to see her still as her, right? We're supposed to see her as Grace, which is an intentional name. Let's be honest, right? Like that name there is so much biblical symbolism in this fucking movie. And Grace is not the end of it. And she's supposed to be wearing white, and she's supposed to be in this wedding dress, and she's supposed to be naive and virginal, if not literally a virgin. And so she, that carries throughout both in her costume and also the way that she tries to continue to survive. I think the way that she continues to seek hope and resolution and has this grit and faith that she's going to get out of this. Like she's going to find a way to save her own life.
That's a great call out of her not changing throughout, because I think in a lot of films similar to this, not that it's a horror comedy, but survivalist type movies, mm-hmm. eventually it's you hit a point where the main character becomes so hardened that now they're fucking Rambo and they're just willing yep. to do whatever. And I don't think Grace ever goes that hard into action hero. She's still pleading with Daniel when we still think mm-hmm. Daniel is a bad guy again when she crashes the car. She's
but
still
she does it by pleading to the good in him.
Yes.
Right?
She's like, Daniel, please. Like she's doing the same
you
thing she did 40
minutes
ago.
You don't want to do this to me. You don't right. want to hurt me. Not please let me survive, right? She's appealing exactly. to the good in him. She's saying, mm-hmm. you don't want to do this. Yeah. And I think that's indicative of who she is as a character.
Yeah, so I think that benefits the story of not having it feel, we know that this is a suspension of disbelief story. We know it's ridiculous, mm-hmm. but I think if you had her lean into that, and they sort of subvert that multiple times when she gets the gun, she loads it, but then the thing won't fucking fire.
But I think
you
that's
think
intentional
that's where
to
it's
your
going.
Point.
Yeah.
You don't want her to become Rambo. She
exactly.
can't.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I think there's so much like to speak to like the intentional or unintentional biblical nature of this, it appears all throughout this. So our cocktail is the LaBelle toast, which mm-hmm. is actually an anagram for Belial, who is the devil, right? In the Old Testament, okay. in the Torah, in tons of lore as well. So, well, it's an iteration of the devil, right? And some people, it's like the devils, the sons of the devil. There's a lot of like sons of Belial is like various demons, things like that. The point is, the whole premise of this is they made a deal with the devil, and the Baal is Belial. Right. This deal has been made with Belial, who's in, again, the Old Testament is in this like biblical story that we're telling. And then you also have this, again, you keep coming back to Latin. Like, I don't know. There's a whole thing about Latin and witchcraft and whatever. Latin is like not a language of ancient anything. Right. This is just something that is referenced a lot in these kind of like spells and grimoires and what have you. And they speak Latin throughout this film, which is referenced many times in things like the occult, this, you know, the Satanic Bible, and things like that. And so
they're isn't that the thing that they're chanting? Isn't that like the satanic equivalent of hallelujah?
There's the Satanic Bible, and then which is like actually published in the 60s. It's not like 1960s. It's not actually old. And then there's actual like occult enchantments, and they mix both in this film.
Okay.
And the name that their family has is Les Domas, which is to tame, to control. Like it's a means to tame something, to control something. Mm. And so they're trying to control their fate. They're trying to control this deal. And it's built in. There's like all this subtle, but not so subtle symbolism of why this is this occult partnership, family, so on and so forth. And so I think it's really interesting that she is juxtaposed against all of that, right? She is simply Grace. She is simply white. She finds all this alarming, and everything that even when she walks in that room, she's like, she's taking it all in this very naive way. And she thinks they're just playing a game, and you find out, of course, how it evolves. And so I think there's just these like nuggets throughout that are really interesting of trying to tell this deeper story of she is being pitted against evil throughout. And how does that manifest in every single character and in this family and so on and so forth?
Well, speaking of Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound, can we just, because I texted you this the other day, can we talk about how good of a fucking scream queen Samara Weaving is?
Which I texted you right back, and I said that's my second to last note in this in my notes on this film is, holy shit, that was a scream. Why do I want to test out my screams now? Like, I immediately was like, I need to go find a pillow and try to figure out a scream like this. She is, and it's that last scene, right? It's that scene as she's the like sun a is
fucking
coming up.
Caged
it's
animal.
Feral. That is a feral scream. And I don't know what they did to bring that out in Samara Weaving, because I don't give a shit what scream queen we're talking about, Jamie Lee Curtis included. That is the most gnarly fucking scream I think I've ever heard. It was insane. Yeah.
They almost, on rewatch, I will say, they almost overdo it. Because you have it when the car is flipping in the crash, they do sort of a slow-mo of her scream. You have it when she has the gnarly fucking gunshot through her palm.
Which
and
is insane. And also, that was very predictable, though. Like that
you
was
know
gonna
when
happen.
She's climbing up, and they sort of foreshadow by showing you that, oh, this is what's going to happen. Yeah, I think that's intentional. But like when she puts in, she does that scream. There's at least two others,
this
and then you get to that one. But
literally
that one is
different wildly different. It's literally wildly different. It is the most feral thing I think I've ever heard on film, short of a person, an actress, and it's not feral, but crazy scream about like a mother experiencing the death of their child. That's the next closest scream I've heard on a screen. And this is, this is wild. And I mean, like, it's crazy that we're spending this much time on it, but I fucking noticed it, and it stands out in this scene. And it is the culmination again of this entire, she has fucking survived. And he says that over and over throughout. He's like, how is she, his dad, Tony or whatever his name is like, how is she getting us all? How is she, you know, killing most of us or protecting herself from most of us? Like, everyone is shocked that this is the way this has gone. Given again, if you just look at her, you think this is going to be an easy one. And I think it is intentional to see that in her and hear that in her, there is this feral part of her that has been through some shit and can deal with her shit and will fuck you up. And all she wanted was to move on from that part of her.
All she wanted was them. She just wanted family, and now they're trying to fucking murder her.
And okay, you want to murder me, bitch? I will murder you back, right? Like, and I love that for her character of like, she is still somehow the innocent one in this of, I just wanted my family. But if you have to tap into the part of me that is feral and survivalist, I will fucking do it. And I like that you don't have much of her backstory other than, oh, she was a foster kid, right? That can mean a million
things. I was going to say, fucking shout out to foster kids out there. You guys, survivors, apparently.
They're, well, yes, always any, like, you're not surviving a home. Like, there are so many things that just fundamentally, you just don't have your family. That in and of itself is disruptive enough. But a lot of times that gets a lot worse, right? And the implication is such that she has been through a lot, even with the way that she talks about her family of they were good people, but they weren't my, they tried their best, but they weren't my people. And so deep down in her, she feels that. She feels the part of her, I think, that she's the only one who will protect her. She is the only one who will take care of her. And that fucking shows here. And it shows in the scream, and it also shows in everything else that she does.
I think it shows on both sides of you see what she is willing to do to survive. And it's just self-defense at this point. But very early on in this process, you see how fucking inept this family is. Like, they have one job. It's like 10 against one.
Which checks out. Let's be honest.
Just, it's the billionaires that couldn't, you know, do a fucking job in a factory. It's just they have no real world.
It's the trust fund billionaires who don't do anything.
Yes. Exactly. Just inherited wealth. I have never had to do anything in any work in my life. I assume I'm going to be great at this, but you just see the idiocy. The drug usage, watching YouTube videos, like,
fucking extra.
And it's, for the record, it is hilarious from a dark comedy standpoint to watch this play out, but it's so true to the real world as well.
I agree, but I think that is another thing that makes Tony interesting as a character and somebody worth considering a little bit longer if he really wanted to. Like, yes, he's fucking terrible and evil, and I'm not saying that, but this is a man who took what he was given, yes, absolutely, and he had privilege that came with that, and he built on it. He calls it out, but so do other people. Like, his family calls it out later, and you can tell that he was very entrepreneurial, right? Yeah. Of like, yeah, I have this baseline that is awesome, but I'm going to fucking commit to the bit. I'm going to turn this into even more of a business that can grow and grow and grow and provide for my family for generations.
I would put him on the next season of Shark Tank if he were still with us.
We would fund him. We would fund him for sure. Absolutely. But I think that's what makes him interesting is that interesting being a flex term, but you can look at he's a man of conviction, right? Like, it's not a good thing. It's not a great thing. We don't like him, but he believes that this is a byproduct of the world that he lives in. And he's going to still work really hard for it. And he's still going to provide for his family. And he's still going to love his family. But this is part of the sacrifice that he has to make in order to be successful. And it doesn't jive with me as a viewer. It doesn't jive against some of these other people, but it does make him interesting to consider just a little bit longer of like what has gotten him to this point. Because if you think about this deal with the devil, he didn't have to do anything. He didn't have to build this empire any further. He just could have cashed in on the deal, you know?
That's a good take on it. He does. Part of him is that sort of bootstraps mentality of, oh, I earned everything. Regardless of where I started in life, I helped my family progress further than that. Yeah.
But I agree, though. Like, I mean, he has a massive leg up here. But I also think he is one of the few who's acknowledging that, right? Yeah. He's saying, I can't do this no matter how industrious I am. I can't be as successful as I am without this. And he still sold his soul to the devil. Don't get me wrong. He is literally selling his soul to reach the heights that he has. But he's not resting on his laurels the way this later generation is, the way his daughter is, the way
That's like as patriarch of the family at that point. How did he raise his children? How did they raise their children? And I think that's where all this ineptitude comes in.
Yeah.
Because now he's like, I need you guys to do one fucking thing. There's like 10 of you. Kill this one person and none of them can do it.
This is your one task. And all you can do is drop your gun and do a line and lose this and like set off a fucking, you know, crossbow that you don't know how to use and kill every person also, in our house who's not the person we're targeting.
Shout out to Melanie Scrofino, who we didn't call out in the opening cast, but she's on Letterkenny and she plays Emily in this. And she, I think she's going to go on to great things. She's such a great comedic actress. But I just think, I feel
she's
like...
She's so annoying as a character in this, though.
She's like, so she's fucking good,
the
though.
The fucking worst, but yes.
I feel like it calls out to Tony his ability to be a good businessman, but not necessarily a good father or husband, because he has not set them up for success in this. And we haven't, I feel like one person who we haven't really touched on too much today is Andy McDowell, who's playing Becky here. Her death scene at the end, when we get the brutal melee beatdown, and then afterward we see the blood.
But doesn't
with
she deserve it? Doesn't she deserve
oh,
it?
Oh, she
let's
absolutely does. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And then the hair on the box that beat her to death. Like, I didn't notice that the first time, and this time I went, like that. Ugh. Yeah. Creepy.
Yeah. Super creepy, super gross. I think it's a really interesting conflict because it's from the outsider to the outsider. Right. Mm-hmm. It's the person mm-hmm. who sort of went through this before, but not exactly. Right. She's aware of it. She knows this family secret, but it is very much implied that she was not subject to this process. So even in that, she has a little bit of privilege over Grace. And she acts and tries to relate to Grace, like, girl, I know where you've been, both before and after the card is pulled. Right. She tries to relate to her before, but you feel this distance between her and her family, and Grace doesn't understand that distance to start. Like, she doesn't get it. Like, I haven't done anything to these people. Why don't they love me or like me or what have you? And you come to find out that a lot of that is that they know this is coming, right? Like, they don't want to assume that she's going to be able to pass this test, even though she is the person who, in theory, brought their golden boy back to the fold. And so nobody's truly invested with her in her until after this has happened. And Becky, her Andy McDowell, is her really only ally that we see pre-card pool. And so for her, Grace, to kill Becky is wild, you know? Yeah. And I think it's really cool in the sense that she has to do that to survive. But it's indicative of the fact that Becky and her are still different. Becky was never really on the same level as her and never went through this in the way
that
she did.
Do you think that's what led to Alex's ultimate heel turn when he sees that his wife has killed his mother? Like, I found on rewatch, I found myself asking that of was, I don't think Alex was evil this whole film. I think he was actually trying to save Grace and run away together, didn't believe in the curse. It's not really until he sees his mother killed that then we get the turn of we need to sacrifice Grace. Like, what? How did you read that as a first-time watcher?
Yeah, I mean, I asked myself that question for sure. I think it's very debatable because I think both things can be true, right? I think that watching his mother's death can be a straw that breaks the camel's back, right? This man, you cannot argue, has been through trauma in 24 hours. He loved Grace in the way that he was capable of loving Grace prior to this card being pulled. And maybe he just always thought the odds were in his favor and he really didn't think this was a threat. Maybe, maybe, maybe on all counts. But I don't think that the decisions that you make in a life or death situation radically change because of something else. I personally read it as this person was always this person and the circumstances formed in such a way that they made the choice that they made is my read. Like, I think he was always, 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 whether his mom died or not, if it came down to this 5 a.m. decision of I'm going to die or Grace has to die, my read about him is that Grace was always going to die.
Yeah. I think that's fair.
That's my take on him. And I think, don't get me wrong, I think that his mother's death is devastating and a contributing factor to, like, the way that he handles Grace in that moment. But I think if you're in a panic and you don't know if this curse is real, you make decisions accordingly. And what Daniel did was say, I don't care about the curse. I don't care if it's real or not. I'm going to back you and try to protect you because you're innocent. And what Alex did was say, I don't know if the curse is real. I don't know if I can protect you or not. But what I am going to do is protect myself in case the curse is real. And I think those are totally different people.
Yeah, that's a good call out. I'll say on, I think this was my third watch of this, that it does feel like you said, it feels like a game time decision of we have reached this point in the night. These people are dead. I'm choosing between you and myself. But I do think that it is literally in that moment he makes that call, because prior to that, all the other actions he has taken is trying to save Grace. He's going to look at the cameras. He's strangling his father of like, you're not going to kill my bride. He gets handcuffed and like frees himself to try and save Grace. But to your point, eventually it's shit or get off the pot time. And he's like, yeah, let's kill my bride.
I think that all is in service of a loophole. You know what I mean? I think that is all in service of, I'm still, whether it's real or not, I'm convincing myself that I can undo, I can control-alt-delete the situation, right? I can control-alt-delete this. I can control-alt-delete this. And I think the thing that maybe the death of his mother does show him is that he can't. He can't control-alt-delete the situation. We are in, you know, the final stages, regardless whether we want to admit it or not. And now you got to make a decision. But again, I think a game time decision still comes down to who you are as a person. And the game time decision that you make is reflective of who you are as a person. That's my read. And I think that we are supposed to see Daniel as a good person who tries to save her and Alex as a person who tries to save himself.
Oh, for sure. By the end, yes. So I'm curious to get your take as we're wrapping up here. Like, as a first-time watcher, what did you think of the ending? Not just in, first off, I don't love the, again, family of six people tying her down, but she somehow kind of gets free of the rope and dodges the knife attack. I don't love that. It's sort of the Indiana Jones escape of just convenient, you know, we need this to happen for the plot. But her escaping, Dawn, like the sun is coming up, and there's sort of a comedic like sigh of relief of, oh, it turns out the curse isn't real and we're fine. Like this.
But
whole
did you
thing
believe
is,
that? On do you remember
the first time
first
I watched?
Watch?
I did. I thought, oh, okay. Fuck, that would be a great ending of like none of this was for
it
anything,
would be a good
and now
ending.
It's just awkward. But then we get the double twist of yes, you are cursed, and now you're all exploding. And Grace, in her snorting laugh way, is you know brushing off Alex. So. As a first time watcher,
I just love that it's fuck Alex
think?
Either way. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I didn't believe that it was the curse wasn't real. I wanted to though. I agree with you. I was like, this could be way more, this maybe not way more, but this is a very interesting way to go with it, right? That the curse isn't real after all this, and then this is all worthless, and that's going to make Alex, that's really going to just show everybody exactly who Alex is. He's going to lose everything no matter what, and like, oh, the comeuppance of it all, right? Like, thought that would be beautiful, but I didn't think that was going to happen. I will say I did think, like, I felt like I could feel the beat. I don't know how to describe that, but I felt like I could feel the beat in the film of waiting for an explosion, or not even an explosion, but just like, this person's going to turn to ash, this person's going to turn to dust, this, whatever. I was waiting for whomever. And in the case, like, as soon as she grabbed the axe though, I was like, she about to die. Like, I mean, 100%, you're like, she going to die. But it was still great. It was still, it gives you that beat of like, I am not 100% sure what's going to happen here. I definitely had a read on it, but I was not 100% sure. And I thought it would be interesting either way. I thought it not being real could be more interesting. I also thought there could be a deep dive with the Alex thing of, does he get any kind of grace, whew, pun intended, because he's married to Grace, right? At the very end, there was a split second of that, of like,
I like that they teased that where he's the last one to go and he's approaching her of like, we're okay. Look, it's not taking me. Yeah.
Will he get a pass? Will he get another second chance? Should he? Absolutely not. But the question is, will he? And I like that that's kind of a question mark. I didn't think that he really would, but I like that they make you consider it for a second. And then that instantaneously, as she throws the ring at him, he's fucking gone.
Yeah. And I think it ties back to what we said earlier of the LaBelle, like, nod of, hey, you're doing great here. Like, good on you for breaking up with him. Because I think that might have decided whether they both died or neither of them died or one of them died. But I was going to say the original ending of this had Grace being sacrificed. And I don't think that jives with the entire thread of the film, not just plot wise, but humor wise. I don't think you can make a horror comedy where evil wins at the end. That's not fucking fun.
No, it's not fun. And it, even if it's not a horror comedy, it doesn't jive with everything we've watched, right? We are rooting for her, right? Yeah. If at the end she dies, then everything we've spent 2 hours rooting for becomes fucking pointless. And don't get me wrong, there are films that do that. I think it's stupid. So I'm glad that they didn't do it because, yeah, I think it's a much more poetic story this way, right? Like, again, she's overcome her trauma. She survived the situation. Nobody thought she would win. She does win. She survives. And it speaks so much to who she is as a person. And she tried to walk into this with real, genuine love. And she left with like, okay, fine. Like, if I just have to survive this, then I have to survive this, which I think could be a larger metaphor for every relationship ever that fails. And you tried to find love and you didn't, and you survived it. Right. And so like, it can be really poetic, and it can also still be really funny. And the way that she closes it out, and, you know, she walks out there and she lights a cigarette, like she said, which, girl, you deserve it, have it. And they ask her what happened, and I'll let you do the honors. What does she say?
Fucking in-laws. The first time I watched it, I rolled my eyes at that final line. I don't know else I would have ended the film, because it is a horror comedy. So you kind of have to have that last little punch to seal the deal.
I both rolled my eyes and laughed, right? Yeah, like, I think it's one of those lines of like, you roll your eyes and laugh. And having had in-laws myself, I was like, yes, girl,
I love Alex being the last one to explode. And just, we talked earlier about the 17 different versions of her wedding dress. And the last version of Grace we get is just blood soaked, like yellow Converse.
They're not yellow anymore, but she still has her cons. They're
probably orange.
Her cons hung in, you know? Yeah. And if that's not an ad for cons, I don't know what is. But yeah, I think it's a great image at the end. She's centered on this back patio. She's smoking. It's fucking blowing up behind her, partially because of her / accidentally. And I think it's a great lasting image. I love how he explodes. I love how she's alone at the end. I love that Daniel didn't die by the curse, right? He died by something else.
If he's got a hero, basically.
Right. If he's gotta die, like, that's the way to die in this scenario. And he's saving her. And I kind of always wanted that for him, and I sort of thought that was coming. So, like, to me, it's a terrible ending, but a happy ending, right? Like, a terrible thing happened.
Get from a character who's cursed, you know?
Yeah, right. It's the most happy ending you're going to get out of a curse. Yes, yeah. 100%. Yeah. For all of them, and her included.
So all of that said, let me gut check you here. What's your rating? You're going to go first this week.
Oh my God, that never happens, and I hate it. I really liked it. I went in with low expectations. So that helps. I would say I'd give it like a 7.5. Like, I had a really good time watching this, and I like the whole time was actively shocked about it. I was like, this is better than I thought it would be. Like, this is a good time. And even after your text, I was like, whatever, Lamar likes horror. Like, I was interested, but I was still like, of course you think it's great. I had a good time. I thought the performances were great. I thought it was a unique concept. I thought the production value was solid. I thought the story arc was interesting. I liked that there was a light nerd factor to it, because I love a nerd factor, and I could deep dive on some nerd shit, you know? I love like an occult and Old Testament, whatever nonsense. Like, I had a good time like researching this and watching this. So yeah, I think I'd give it like a solid 7.5. And I think it's worth a watch for sure.
That's pretty good. I've transparently, I felt like I had to text you and sort of set you up for success of don't go into this expecting a horror movie. I don't want you to think it's scary.
Yeah.
It is very much a silly comedy film with dark horror undertones. So that was a very conscious decision on my part. I'm sorry. But
he was lobbying on the back end is what I'm hearing. Okay. Okay.
But yeah.
It's not a bad idea. It's not a bad idea. I support you.
But yeah, for me, about the same. I think the first time I watched it, I'd give it about a 7.5. I think on rewatch, I'd bump it up to like an 8. I think it accomplishes everything it wanted to accomplish. It's funny. It's kind of horrifying in different parts. I do think there's probably a couple things to fix in there. Mm-hmm. But the wrap up, just the last 20 minutes are pretty much flawless. So when you when you nail the first 20 minutes and the last 20 minutes, the stuff in between, I think, is more acceptable. And this is one of those cases where, oh, I would have left out this scene or I would have changed this. I don't think you needed the dumbwaiter girl getting killed in that. It just seemed out of place. And that the butler stuff goes on a little too long.
I liked the dumbwaiter as a feature. Like, let's feature a dumbwaiter. That's always a good time, which, fun fact, is also in The Watcher. But it was too much when she did that. That scene was too much. And I agree. I was just about to say the butler was annoying to me. He was fucking maniacal. He doesn't have the same buy-in to this thing as the family does. And he is leaned in as though he is a beneficiary and he's a fucking butler. Like, you're like,
maybe
I'm sorry.
They pay really well. You don't know.
I don't think they pay well enough to scald your face off, my guy. Like, or to commit murder, right? Like, you cannot pay well enough to murder someone in the household. And so, yeah, I agree. I think that went on a little long.
Solid facts. But yeah, solid 8 for me.
I love it. I even told a couple people to watch it already. That's how much you can tell that I liked this one, which is a thing.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. I was a little worried.
Well, thanks for suggesting it. And again, I think we have a good mix this month. I think we have a healthy mix of stuff, which I really like. So speaking of, thank you for joining us for this one. I think this is a really good time, as evidenced by the amount of time we talked about it. But come back next week to do our final entry for our Love Stinks month, Blue Valentine, which Lamar has never seen and is about to have a rough time.
Probably. I don't understand, because in my history, in my experience, Valentines are red. So I feel like there's something there metaphor wise of like something might be different about this.
I'm gonna let you watch it and report back. You let us know what you find out there. In the meantime, however.
In the meantime, follow us on our socials. We drink and we watch things, mostly on Instagram with our reels and on TikTok. You can watch video of this recording on YouTube or Spotify video. And then finally, you can email us anytime at wedrinkandwewatchthingspod@gmail.com with thoughts, reactions, suggestions, questions, things we fucked up, all that good stuff.
Lamar doesn't check it, so be kind, okay?
I don't check it at all, but I'm getting really good at delivering that entire spiel.
You are.
Deep, so.
You are. Thank you. Thank you so much. All right. Well, for now, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers.
And maybe go light on the gin. Okay.